Speak, O Lord, your servants heareth. Amen. Please be seated. Well, indeed, it is one of those days when I get such a kick out of lessons and how we respond to them, because we go into automatic mode when we listen to this, especially this first lesson. Tony finishes the lesson quite properly with, "This is the word of the Lord." And we instantly reply,
Thanks
be to God. For this? Are you kidding? Did you read this? This is the language of violence. It's the language of judgment. How is it possibly good news? Or the psalm. The psalm is also... You wonder how somebody could call this good news of the gospel, the last words of the gospel. Throw the guy out into outer darkness where there's weeping, wailing, and gnashing of teeth. And we say, this is the good news. Now it is, and it can be construed that way, but I want to look at something slightly different. Last week we looked at the story of Joshua and the Israelites invading the land of Canaan, and how they justified it. And also, we talked about the sort of Jesus test that Luther uses when looking at passages that are full of violence and just are very troublesome. Luther's test, does anybody remember what Luther's test was? To know if it's really authentic. If you can imagine Jesus saying those things, it's authentic. If you cannot imagine Jesus saying those things, then it does not have authority over us. Because we are followers of Jesus Christ, who is the Son of God, who in fact helps us to know how to live our lives. And so when we are confronted with texts that are full of violence, our first response can be, should be, perhaps, is this something Jesus would say? And if not, I don't call it good news. It's not good news. Not directly, anyway. The one thing about this particular text, or these particular texts, is that they provide us language for judgment. We get our understanding of judgment from texts like these, and therefore we need texts like these because we need to know when and how to apply judgment. Now, I'm sure I'm like you, or you're like me, like most, you know, good church people around the world, certainly among mainline churches. We have forgiveness, we have grace, we have freedom, we have love. And these are abounding every Sunday in all of the mainline churches. That's what we hear. We hear love, grace, forgiveness, and that is what draws us in. How about judgment? Not so much. We don't hear too much judgment in the mainline churches. And why is that? I certainly can attest to remembering when the priest or the pastor or the church use the language of judgment to control us. They use the language of judgment to get us to think the way they wanted us to think and act the way they wanted us to act. And if we didn't do it quite the way they suggested, the way they commanded, then we were in danger of going to hell. Now that's very much in the background of many people here. Certainly it's in my background. This idea that judgment can only be negative has crept into our mainline churches, and it makes it very difficult for us then to confront difficult issues when they arise. Because there are issues that arise in our life, in our common life together, that in fact call for judgment. Without the language of judgment, we don't have a language of justice. Without the language of judgment, we can't understand how we are to construct a world that is to be truly just. Without the language of judgment, It's like we're burying our heads in the sand and refusing to admit that the world is a dangerous and scary place. But what is judgment? And how does God's judgment relate to God's justice? Judgment, as it's understood in the Bible and really pretty much everywhere, judgment is a hammer. It's a hammer of punishment. Judgment is used to redress cruelty, arrogance, and self-righteousness. The problem is, what do we do when we use the language of justice to attack something, to oppose something, quite properly? How do we prevent the language of judgment to get twisted into the very thing that we tried to get away from, where it's no longer the language of judgment serving justice, it's the language of judgment serving the people in power? How much I would like to say, everybody's wrong and I am right. How do we prevent judgment from undermining justice? I'm going to suggest that what prevents judgment from undermining justice is one word. It's one quality. It's one thing. It's a gift of God called mercy. Mercy. Now, usually when we use the word mercy, we're using it in a way to close off judgment. And we might say things like, well, this is a church that preaches judgment. This is a church that preaches mercy. As if they were two completely separate things. And that we have to always keep them separate. But in fact, if we understand judgment dialectically, what that means is that judgment and mercy are always related. They can never be separated one from another. And the more you emphasize one, the more you have to emphasize the other. Because imagine a string, and you're holding, and one drops the string, and the other one drops it. They both have to go together. In judgment, mercy is connected. And so when we bring words of judgment, we also must bring words of mercy. Now, however, there is a balance, and there must remain a balance between judgment and mercy, because they are not the same. And you can't just flow them into one another. They are distinct and separate, but they are related in such a way so that every time we make a judgment call, we must also call for mercy. Question: how can this understanding of judgment and justice apply in the current situation of sexual harassment and assault? Here's the question for you. How should we treat people who have been justly accused of sexual harassment or assault? Now, I want you to hear one word especially: justly. Because anybody can make an accusation about anything. But here we're talking about only those accusations which are justly made. So the question is, how should we treat people who have been justly accused of sexual harassment or assault? How do we work the dialectic between judgment and mercy? What should be our primary concern in these cases of sexual assault and harassment? When does mercy apply for the wrongdoer? Here's my attempt to answer that question, and I'm going to suggest that we discuss it. When do we bring down the hammer of judgment, including the legal hammer, and when do we allow for mercy? When do we permit perpetrators of sexual harassment or assault and allow them to be brought back into the community in mercy and full acceptance? Should they be forbidden to ever work in their field again? Should they be forever shunned? Now, these are not hypothetical questions. These are questions which everybody is asking right now. Should certain actors be forbidden to be in a movie again or a play because they have been accused justly of sexual abuse? Should our politicians who have been justly accused of sexual abuse, should they be forced to give up their seats, or should they be allowed to come back in a later date and return to their positions of authority? Now, I need to say right away, before we get too far, that this is not only a problem for women. It's a problem for LGBTQ people who are constantly harassed and assaulted. There are also men and boys, and we don't fully understand, but we do know that the amount of sexual abuse of boys is very high. No one really thought about it until we watched the movie Spotlight in the Boston Globe. I've come up with a test for answering the question, how do we respond to the one who has been justly accused of sexual harassment or abuse? First, do they publicly acknowledge their sin and admit what they did? Do they publicly acknowledge their sin and admit what they did? The word that's important here is publicly. Because in most cases, it's the public that is affected. So in the simplest way, when a woman is assaulted or made to be fearful, she can't go about her ordinary life. That affects the whole country. That affects our economy. It affects the way we raise our children. It affects our relationships with each other as spouses. It must be a public acknowledgement of their sin and an admission of what they did. Number two, do they recognize that they were wrong and they caused real and lasting harm? Do they recognize that they were wrong and they caused real and lasting harm? Number three, do they publicly apologize with sincerity and perhaps even brokenness? Do they publicly acknowledge with sincerity, apologize with sincerity, and perhaps even brokenness? Four, was this a once-only event, or was it part of a pattern of repeated assaults? Do they publicly acknowledge their sin and admit what they did? Do they recognize that they were wrong and caused real and lasting harm? Do they publicly apologize with sincerity? Was this a one-off, or is there a pattern? Or do they find ways to say that it was not their fault? Do they find ways to say that, in fact, it was her fault? She came on to me. She dressed a certain way. She wanted certain favors from me that I could give. It's her fault. Do they find ways of retribution and retaliation against their victims? So, these seven tests. Do they acknowledge their sin? Do they recognize they were wrong? Do they apologize publicly? Or do they find ways to say that it was not their fault, that it was her fault? And do they commit acts of retribution and retaliation against their victims? If they acknowledge their sin and crime and make no attempt to blame their victim, if they are deeply apologetic and accept punishment without complaint, then I think, and this is just me, then I think that they should be allowed to work and be fully involved in community life, with one caveat. If the assault involved children or people that are incapacitated, in that case, the judgment outweighs the mercy. Mercy is always present because even the most heinous person must be treated with dignity, and that's where mercy allows and demands us to treat even the criminal with dignity. But in this case, where children are involved, heavy is the hammer for punishment. I'm going to give you some examples of cases right now that are in the public eye and ask you to consider what should be done with them. Should be the hammer of justice or the balm of mercy? Which one? Of course, there always will be both. But which should be paramount in each of these circumstances? There's man number one, a powerful man in politics running for the United States Senate. There is overwhelming evidence that he is guilty of sexual assault of a minor. He was once widely known throughout his community for preying on girls as young as 14. All his victims were between the ages of 14 and 18, while he was in his 30s. He strongly denies all charges, accuses his accusers of being politically motivated, even though they all belong to the same party. He has mounted a vigorous public campaign to discredit the woman. Which should come down, the hammer or mercy? Which should weigh more in this case, the hammer of punishment or of mercy?
Hammer.
Hammer. Anybody else?
Hammer.
Why?
Children.
Because children. Anybody else? Yeah, children. Okay. They didn't, according to this list, they didn't act according to in the better positive cases. Yes, that's right. They did, in fact, this man number one, in fact, is waging a huge campaign against the women who have come forward to say that when they were girls that he abused them. And so there is a very strong attack to humiliate them, to destroy their credibility, to destroy their careers, and yet they still come forward. Then there's man number two, another powerful man in politics. Upon being accused of unwanted kissing and touching, man number two issued a full apology, admitting that the accuser was right, and he makes no attempt to defend himself. In this case, they both were adults when the event happened. There were no other charges of unwanted sexual behavior that we know of. Quite remarkably, he went to the Senate Ethics Committee and asked that there be a Senate Ethics Committee hearing and probe of his own activity, which will guarantee him great public humiliation. What do we say about man number two?
Mercy.
Mercy, why?
Because it's not a repeat.
It's not a repeat in what? He acknowledges and asks for acknowledges what he did was wrong. He asks for forgiveness. Okay, good. Man number three is one of the most powerful men in the world of filmmaking. He preyed on young female actors who were hoping for their big break, and they might have a small part in a movie that he is producer of. He's the money man of, and he would invite young women up to his hotel room on the shoot site, and there he would talk about she's going to be a great actress and so forth, but then he assaults her, and 80 women have come forward to talk about the assault and the rape that this man committed to them. He has denied all charges and has threatened to sue the 80 women who have gone public with their stories of assault. What do we do with him?
Huge hammer.
Huge hammer. Huge hammer. Why?
Repeat offender.
Repeat offender? No acknowledgement. What was?
No remorse.
No remorse.
Retaliatory.
Yeah, you know, when I hear you're zeroing in right on all the issues, and it makes us realize that we can't lump these all together, can we? And the tendency is to say, well, they're all bad. They're all bad guys. They are. But to lump them all together would be to do an injustice. And so that's one of the reasons mercy is always a part of judgment. Justice for the Christian is always the balance between judgment and mercy. When that balance is aligned, then we have justice. Now, there are many other figures in the world of entertainment and certainly the world of politics that famous, well-known, important people have been guilty of sexual crimes, but we would spend the rest of the day and all tomorrow counting them up. The thing that's so distressing for me and probably for you, is that the women that have come forward are all pretty well known. They're pretty famous. Many of them now have connections. What about the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of women who have no connections? They've got nobody in their corner. They live with shame and humiliation. And more than that, they live with fear. Somebody walks up in a parking lot and knocks on your window and you jump. Because you don't know what's that all about. That thousands upon thousands of women have nobody in their corner. They will never be in a courtroom across from their accuser. They will go to their graves living with the pain and the suffering and the anguish and the rage that comes from being assaulted when no one seems to care or believe you. If this moral examination makes sense to you, I'd encourage you this week to start conversations on this subject at home, among colleagues and co-workers and friends. As followers of Jesus Christ, it's our duty to bring morality, moral questions like this, into public conversations. Now, finally, to put it together with our gospel lesson. The gospel lesson is one of these, once again, the ending of it is terrible. Outer darkness. What's this all about? What this is all about, it'll be very brief on this. It's often been seen to be talents like skills. God gave me talents. I got 5 talents, and I work on my 5 talents, and I produce 5 more. Well, that doesn't really make sense, but that's what it seems to say. Or it means money. I take money, and that's the metaphor that Jesus is using. Jesus is using the metaphor of talent, of money, to talk about something else. And what is he talking about? He's talking about God gives each of us, throughout our lives, occasions to do his will. God gives us, each of us, challenges to do his will. 1 time, 2 times, 5 times, 10 times. Some people are given a lot of challenges, and some are given very few, and we don't know why. But the fact of the matter is that the challenges do come to everybody. It's not money. It's not skill. It's the challenge to be responsible in the world, in a world that's created by God and redeemed by Jesus Christ. It's a world that needs us to bring love and mercy and compassion and judgment into the world. I'm going to give an example. You remember, many of you remember, 1963, I believe it was, Birmingham, Alabama. A bomb went off in a church, and 4 little girls were killed. And in the jail of Birmingham, Alabama, were a couple hundred men, women, and children, one of whom was Martin Luther King. And while they're in jail, because they've been demonstrating against injustice and racial, marching for racial justice and freedom, somebody gets to King the newspaper editorial that says, that argues that King and his marchers were responsible for the explosion that killed the 4 little girls. It's one of the most important 20th century documents in America. It's called The Letter from a Birmingham Jail. Martin Luther King, getting scraps of paper, writes a response to the editorial. The editorial was written by the white clergy of Birmingham. The white clergy of Birmingham said, "We agree that there is an injustice, but you're moving too fast. Slow it down. We have to do this over generations." The white ministers of Birmingham, Alabama, were given a challenge. They were given a challenge from God to do the right thing. They didn't get 10, they didn't get 5, they only had 1 to do. They had the challenge of defending the oppressed, and yet they refused to do so. They had a chance to fulfill God's command, and instead they hid when called upon. They knew the right thing to do, and they failed to do it. One thing, that was all. All they had was one challenge, and they ducked and ran away. So the question comes to us. What are we going to do in that moment when we can make a difference by what we do and what we say? For example, about the assault, sexual assault against women. When you know what is right, when you know what you should do, and you refuse to do it, what will that mean for you, for me, for us? Maybe you don't want to alienate members of the family. I mean, Thanksgiving is coming up. Maybe you don't want to alienate people in the church or colleagues at work or neighbors or friends. But each of us is given at least one opportunity to make a difference in the world. Each of us are given one more challenge throughout our lives, one or more challenges throughout our lives. How will we respond to these challenges? I hope each of us will be able to say with Joshua last week, "Choose this day whom you will serve. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." May it be so among us as well.